This is a recording for the Pam Comperta teleconference with Joint Commission Thursday, March 1st, 2018, scheduled for 11:30 a.m. Central Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have our presenters in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of our presenters' presentations, we will open the floor for questions. Instructions will be given at that time on the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn this conference over to Pam Comperta. Ms. Comperta, you may begin.
Thank you so much, Chantal. Hi, everyone. This is Pam Comperta from the Joint Commission's Community Health Center program. Welcome to our March monthly educational teleconference. Everyone should have received the presentation via email or a communication that was sent out Friday and then earlier this week. So if you did not receive that or would like me to send you another copy, please send me an email at my email address, pkomperda@jointcommission.org, and I will send over the presentation to you momentarily. So again, thank you all for joining today. We have a great topic for today's session. Today's session will be a discussion of the safety and quality challenges faced by health centers that provide dental care. And we're going to explore how and when Joint Commission standards are applicable to the services provided in a dental department. Today, we have Dr. Afro from the Joint Commission. He's going to highlight some of the most challenging standards cited in dental. But before we jump into our presentation, I'm very happy to share that we have HRSA's dental officer with us today, Dr. Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen has served as a dental officer with the Bureau of Primary Health Care's Office of Quality Improvement at HRSA for the past 2 years, where she leads the oral health and primary care integration portfolio for the health center program. So with that, Dr. Nguyen, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to turn over the call to you for some opening remarks.
Thank you, Pam. Hi, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to be able to join today's call. I'm very excited for today's topic around safety and quality within the dental setting. It plays a very important role, especially within the work that we do here in the Office of Quality Improvement. So I wanted to share a little bit of context to the Bureau of Primary Health Care's mission, as well as our strategic goals that are used to advance our work here in the health center program. The Bureau's mission is focused on improving the health of our nation's most underserved and vulnerable populations and communities, and we do that by assuring access to comprehensive quality primary care services. And so stemming from our overall mission, we have three strategic goals that help guide our activities and our investments. The first is to increase access to primary health care. Through this goal, we want to strive towards a truly comprehensive health home for our patients, providing access to a wide range of services that is also inclusive of oral health care. It's also important to have a system and workflows in place where there is continuous collaboration and coordination between all providers and staff, both in the medical and dental sides, jointly working together in all aspects of providing care to the community. So this includes making sure that, you know, we have dental representation in a health center QI/QA program, as well as having our dental colleagues actively involved in QI/QA assessments and plans. The second goal is to advance health center quality and impact. In addition to being able to provide access to a range of comprehensive health services, we want to ensure that we're all also focused on the quality of care that is provided. And as we all know, patient safety, which includes infection prevention and control, is really a cornerstone of high-quality care. And lastly, we're striving to optimize and improve our own operations within the Bureau of Primary Health Care to better support the work that is done at health centers. We want to be able to support health centers through any needed training, technical assistance, or resources that are useful and valuable in order to support health centers in providing that high level of quality of care to our health center patient population. So I want to thank the Joint Commission as well as my colleagues in the APCMH team for inviting me today and providing this great opportunity for all of us to learn a little bit more about some ways and some strategies to improve patient safety and quality of care as it relates in the dental setting. So with that, I will turn it back over to you, Pam. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nguyen. Thank you for joining us today, too. We really appreciate it and like having you on our call. So now we're going to, I have the pleasure to introduce Jay Afro. Dr. Jay Afro is a surveyor for the Joint Commission's Ambulatory Healthcare Accreditation Program. Jay is the Executive Director of Clinical Compliance in Wentworth Douglas Health System in Dover, New Hampshire. Dr. Afro provides continuing education and support to health centers, collaborating with organizations to improve the care provided to their patients. So, Dr. Afro, I will now turn the presentation over to you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Pam. It's good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're listening in from around the country. It's a great honor for me to be able to present this presentation again. I've done similar presentations at some of our other Joint Commission conferences, and this 1 hour or so on dental seems to probably generate the most questions that I get whenever I present at any of the Joint Commission meetings. So this is just another venue where we can get the information out. If you look at on your presentations, we jump over to slide 3, which is where we'll just start the presentation, is what I like to say is don't forget about dental. That's a phrase that many of you, if I've surveyed your organization, you've probably heard me say, especially at an opening conference, because I'll frequently hear comments from organizations that will say, well, we're a mercury-free facility because we've gotten rid of all of our blood pressure cuffs, or our dental medications won't be on their formulary or on their hazardous material list. So often I'll even start out when I do my opening conference with organizations that have dental programs, even tell them about, just have them, it's not so much if dental would be, if the Joint Commission standards are applicable to dental, it's how to apply them to dental. And unfortunately, I have a lot of great and wonderful colleagues I work with in the nursing and the medical field, and the minute I mention the term dental, they start to break into a cold sweat. Anytime I use the term dental, says the guys, if it makes you feel any better, think about dental, take the word dental out of your vocabulary and call it oral medicine. Because think of it as medicine, but just of a particular part of the body. And then when I kind of go through my list of 8 things that we do in the oral medicine department, all of a sudden the eyes start opening and the light bulbs start going off over people's heads. And I said, guys, we perform invasive procedures. We utilize and store hazardous materials. We inject medications. We sterilize instruments. We get informed consent. We use PPE. We are responsible for providing medication information to patients. And we probably have some look-alike, sound-alike, and all of a sudden everyone goes, I get it. All of a sudden it starts to make sense to say, if this was a women's health clinic or this was a primary care clinic or a surgical clinic or whatever clinic you have in your facility, all of a sudden I go, just because we call it oral medicine or dental doesn't mean that there's different bugs that we don't have to worry about for sterilizing, and it's not different processes we use for consent. It's basically the same process. So try not to, for some reason there's this mental block for folks that, oh, it's dental, so these things don't really apply. So in order to try and get that point home, what I did is I put together a very quick scenario on slide 4, which is, having spent many years in community dental clinics, this was a very, very common situation, just to show you that patient safety is relevant to dental. So we would have, the typical scenario might be a 20-year-old patient reports to the clinic for an evaluation of pain for a lower left molar. I would see cases like that numerous times every day that I was providing care. We did an exam. Medical history was reviewed. We looked at their medications they were taking. We did an exam. We took the appropriate x-ray films of the patient. And after we discussed with the patient, it was a pretty broken-down tooth, probably not restorable, we went ahead with an extraction of the tooth using local anesthesia. And, it sounds like a pretty basic process, and it's something we do thousands of times every year in our dental programs. And how would we really apply the Joint Commission standards to that process? And often when I ask organizations up front or even started, talking to the leadership of the organization, I'll kind of get a little bit of the deer in the headlights. Well, why would that apply? So if we jump over to slide number 5, and I'll just kind of walk folks through how every one of these different standards that we'll talk about would apply to that very simple, straightforward, very common situation that you would see in your dental programs. So under our environment of care standards, do we have any hazardous materials and waste we'd be worried about? Are we potentially going to have sharps? Yeah, probably. We may have some blood-soaked material, blood or body fluid-soaked gauze or material. That's likely in this situation. Could we have a tooth that needs to be disposed of? Could we have amalgam that's in the tooth that could be needed to be disposed of? So all of those things would hit our environment of care, disposal of hazardous waste and materials. Is the equipment we're using up to date, and then it's got its appropriate preventive maintenance inspections and ongoing requirements from the manufacturer? So our biomed standard would kick into place here. Is the X-ray machine up to grade? Is it meeting the appropriate settings that it should have? And did it have its state inspections if it's required in your state? In human resources, are our staff qualified? Maybe the dental assistant who's taking our X-rays for our patient, are they competent, qualified, oriented, received all of the appropriate training that they should? If your state requires licensing or certification of your dental assistants, did that occur? In states where I practice, the dental assistants, in order to take X-rays, also had to have radiology certification. So do they have the appropriate qualifications for wherever you're located? Have they received the appropriate orientation and trainings, ongoing training if there is especially if you've got new equipment or new supplies that they're using? How do you assess competency of your dental assistant and or dental hygienist? Because neither one is considered an independent practitioner, so they're going to have some sort of job description that we need to ensure that whatever clinical skills they're providing, they're competent and you're assessing their competency. And then we have our dentist or oral surgeon who's working on our patient. Have they received the appropriate credentialing and privileging? And this tends to be a large challenge for many health centers, not understanding that you would basically credential and privilege any dentist, oral surgeon, any other dental specialty, exactly the same way you would credential and privilege any of your other medical providers. Now, kind of a word of warning, many of you will use the AMA profiles when you're doing your medical provider credentialing and privileging or when you want to do their license and education validation. The American Dental Association recently has started their own kind of ADA profile, but there's one caution that I will put out there is, at their own admission, the current database that they're using is not what we refer to as primary source verified. It is self-reported. So it's a good start, but it would not be accepted as primary source because it's being reported by the provider, not by the state licensing agency or the particular school they went to. They have said, when I've asked the question, where they're going with this, they said, well, they wanted to get it up and running, and eventually they will go to a primary source situation. But so please don't use that as your one and only source. That'll get you in a little bit of trouble. The other is when you're delineating privileges for your providers, like you would do for your women's health providers or any of your other primary care providers, don't privilege folks, and I've seen this numerous times, the Dr. Afro was privileged in dentistry. That would be kind of the equivalent of saying on the medical side, we privilege somebody to provide medical care. You'd want, depending on what methodology you use, whether you use kind of what I call the core privileging method or kind of the other shopping list method of privileges, make sure you've got a similar process. But privileging somebody to do dentistry is a little broad and a little too generic, and it's really not giving us any guidance as to what this person can or can't do. If we skip over to slide 6, we've got some pretty significant infection control things, and especially in most health centers, dental and usually followed by women's health in number 2 is probably doing the most sterilization of anybody. Just because the volume of patients, virtually every patient that we're treating has some sort of instrument used on them. So it's not uncommon for the dental department to be running their autoclaves half a dozen times a day. Wouldn't be considered an unusual amount. So, we'd be looking for what we call implementation of infection control activities, meaning, are we cleaning appropriately? Are we doing sterilization appropriately? Surface cleaning being done according to whatever product you're using? Are you following all the correct steps of doing the sterilization process, everything from cleaning in the room to transporting the instruments in a impervious bin, closed impervious container, down to the sterilization area, wherever that may be, cleaning the instruments appropriately, and then so forth and so on, all the way till the process recycles around. Also on medication, we're going to, most patients appreciate a little local anesthesia during a tooth extraction. Frequently, I find that many of the dental anesthetics are not on the organization's formulary because they're not real medication, so we don't put them on the formulary. I can assure you that septicane, lidocaine, carbacane, mepivacaine, marcaine, and all the other canes that we use in dental are considered prescription medications, so they should be on your formularies. So just include them like any other medication. no different than the lidocaine that your women's health provider or your primary care provider is using in their operatory. Ours just come in little smaller cartridges, but it's the exact same medication. For those of you that haven't wandered into the dental clinic, ask if you if your facility has septicane and carbacane, ask them for to show you an example of both of those cartridges. It is probably the best example of a look-alike, sound-alike medication that you will see because they look almost identical. And again, frequently we don't include dental look-alike, sound-alike medications on the organization-wide list. How do we store these medications? Are they stored just like any other medication with limited access? And do they have emergency meds and supplies? Again, you can determine what exactly those would be, and a lot of that's related to what kind of medical support you have in the building, as well as how quickly would you get EMS support if you called 911. Are they, you know, a minute away from your building, or I've been to some health centers where it could be an hour for someone for help to arrive. So again, depending on what your access to emergency services might be, you might have different items in your emergency meds and supplies, but you know, that would be, again, another thing we might ask in the dental department. How would you respond to a reaction to a local anesthetic, which, again, for the good news is it's a rare event, but the bad news is should it occur, it's going to be a pretty significant event. If we jump over to slide 7, four of the national patient safety goals would apply. Just about all of them would apply in dental in this particular situation. Do we have the right patient? Something as basic as using two identifiers. Patient name and date of birth would apply because this is, you would consider, a surgical-type situation. Medication reconciliation. This is frequently a challenge in dental because many medical EMR programs print out a wonderful med list at the end of the visit. Dentrix, Eaglesoft, Easy Dental, and any of the other dental programs that I've ever come across do not do this. So the question is, how do we deal with a medication reconciliation situation, especially if we either A, ask the patient to hold some existing medications like a Coumadin prior to an extraction, or on the back end, if we've prescribed an antibiotic or a pain medication, how do they get instructions as to how to take it, and if they're on other pain medication or antibiotics, should they hold any of those? So how do we reconcile the medication that they're going to, or the take-home meds? Hand washing, obviously, that would be an issue at all ends, whether it's instrument cleaning or in the patient exam room. And then the universal protocol, how do we assure we got the right patient, the right procedure, and the right location? On slide number 8, even the provision of care chapter would apply to that same scenario because we're going to have an assessment, which in the dental world we call an examination and charting. A pain assessment would be relevant. How much pain are you in? And I've often had many of the dental folks ask me, you know, why would I need a pain assessment? I said, well, you know the patient's in pain, but this patient comes back 2 or 3 days later and says, hey, my pain is now a 10. You'd really like to know what was their baseline before you touched that patient, because they may still be not that comfortable, but they might be better off than they were the day before the extraction, or things might be getting worse, maybe leading to some other potential complications. So in my opinion, it's really good to have a baseline pain assessment. I know once they're anesthetized, obviously they're not going to be able to give you that, but preoperatively it's a good place to start from, especially if you're one of those clinics where the patient may not see the same provider visit after visit. What's your treatment plan? Again, just that, you know, in medicine we call it a care plan, in dentistry we call it a treatment plan, and learning needs assessment would certainly be applicable here because how do we, you know, if the patient tells you they're a video learner, are they an audio learner, are they a visual learner, are they, you know, you've got to demonstrate them. You know, we want to make sure that when this patient goes home, they're doing their oral care appropriately, they're taking their medications appropriately. So what methodology do they like, what would they prefer you to use? And now if you have a kind of a combined record, which some health centers do, this data may already have been collected by your medical folks or the different intake, and you may have access to it. But often dental sitting alone in its own either paper or electronic record where you may have to collect it on your own an additional time. Also, on if we skip over to slide number 9, record of care. Again, a record's complete. It's no different than a medical record. The records are complete and authenticated, and under patient rights, the appropriate communication is provided. Patients still need interpreters in dental just the way they would on the medical side. And how do we obtain informed consent? Is it your front desk asking to sign a piece of paper before they walk in the door, and there's no conversation that goes on? That really wouldn't be the ideal or optimal situation. Is there actually a conversation going on with the patient? Because I always like to tell folks, informed consent is not the piece of paper, it's the conversation that goes on. The paper just documents the fact that you had the conversation. So all of these things in that very simple, straightforward scenario that you probably see a dozen times a day in your facilities, just about every chapter in the Joint Commission Standards Manual would be applicable. And again, it's not if it's applicable, it's just how to think about applying it to the dental setting. So as we now go on to slide number 10, I'm going to kind of highlight out some of the other risk areas that I've seen over the last 15 years or so of surveying. One is minimizing the risk with radiation. Again, we tend to take a lot of x-rays and films of our patients. Lots of questions come up around lead aprons. What do I need to do? The Joint Commission says dot, dot, dot. Joint Commission doesn't say a whole lot. It basically says you determine the inspection frequency, method, what's your policy and process. So I may ask your dental assistant, your dental hygienist, or your dentist, what's your policy or process for making sure that your lead aprons are working effectively? And there's some other reasons to do this. OSHA and some others require that you have safe lead shielding for employees. If your health center happens to have a radiology department, often they'll send the aprons periodically once, maybe twice a year, down to radiology to be x-rayed. If you don't have that luxury, I don't recommend, you know, taking lots of little films in the dental department. That's not a really effective use of your time. But OSHA also allows you to do what's called, I call it the touch test, where you just lay the apron down on a flat surface and run your hand over it trying to feel for any cracks or deviations in the lead lining on the inside. What typically is the bigger problem with the lead aprons is not necessarily the cracks on the inside, because we don't find those very often, especially if your folks are really good about hanging the lead aprons appropriately. Where you run into trouble is when people try and fold them into fours, and that's when you're going to crack the lead. What typically is more of a problem is the outer surface, especially with all the products we're using to clean them, you know, the Sani cloths and the Cavi wipes and things like that. Eventually what happens is a lot of that vinyl lining will dry out, and I've seen some that look like a cat got loose on them, and they start splitting and cracking open. That would be time to replace that apron. So that's one thing to keep an eye on. On slide number 11, equipment maintenance. Things like ultrasonics, and just about every dental department I've ever visited has some shape or form of an ultrasonic, everything from a tabletop to one that's built into the countertop, and they run from very small to pretty good-sized ones. The only thing we're going to be looking for is, are you following the manufacturer's instructions for how to clean it and maintain it? Generally, the rule of thumb is you empty the solutions daily, or if kind of not looking so clear, clean and clear, if you've done a couple of really bloody extractions, you're probably going to want to change the solution after a couple of those ultrasonic runs and not wait till the end of the day. There is something called the foil test, which, again, is not required, but it's kind of recommended, where you will hold a piece of tin foil across the inside of your ultrasonic, turn it on, and see if you get the pitting of the aluminum foil. That'll kind of give you a sense of how well and how effective your ultrasonic is working, because over time, the motors in the ultrasonics, the transistors, will start to die out, and you won't see it till eventually that the machine finally dies, but it kind of goes on a curve that after several years, you'll start to see its effectiveness starting to decrease over a period of months and years. So if you ever want to convince yourself that your ultrasonic is working, if you even go on to Google and just put in pictures of the ultrasonic foil test, and you'll see what kind of a good passing and a not-so-good passing piece of aluminum foil would look like. If we go on to slide number 12, autoclaves. That's kind of really critical to what we're doing in dental. Again, we're going to, you know, many of you using the Midmark M9s, M11 autoclaves, which is one of the most common ones out on the market. They have a daily, a weekly, a monthly maintenance requirement. And what our standard and standard requires is that you are doing the maintenance, and most organizations are doing that if they're aware of it. The bigger challenge tends to be there's also a documentation requirement. So once you're doing the daily, weekly, and monthly maintenance on the autoclave, make sure it's being documented somewhere. I think, you know, one of the best methods I ever saw was somebody just printing out blank calendars off of their Microsoft Word program, you know, for each month, and somebody was highlighting, you know, the dailies, obviously, or somebody's initialing it every day. The weeklies, maybe somebody decided every Monday we'll do those, and they picked, for example, the last day of the month to do the monthly inspection. So just on one calendar, you could capture all three of them. But if you happen to like the list methodology or other ways, we really don't specify the method of using it, just as long as when I come in and ask you, show me that you've been doing the appropriate maintenance on the autoclave, that makes it a whole lot easier. What often happens, and I'll ask, do you have the owner's manual, the instruction manual for the autoclave? And occasionally I'll kind of get that, oh, God, we don't have that. We haven't seen it in 5 years since we installed the autoclave. That's really important to have because in it will tell you exactly, you know, it's like I tell people it's like buying a car and never looking at the owner's manual, how often you should change the oil. Your typical garden variety autoclave will run you somewhere in the ballpark of $10,000 to $12,000. So that's something you want to do some maintenance on because every one of these service people that I've talked to says if you do the maintenance at the appropriate intervals, you will get several years more use out of that autoclave than if you don't keep up with it and clean the filters and drains and things like that. That you'll be replacing that $10,000 to $12,000 unit a lot quicker than you should be. Most of the good manufacturers, I know at least Midmark does this, is they will even provide you with a laminated card that you can hang right above the autoclave. It's washable, it's easy to clean. That will give you the instructions on how to do the maintenance on the autoclave so there's no, so people don't have to go looking for it on a daily basis. Also, your handpieces, depending on what you're using, there are more and more of the electric ones coming out of the market, but if you're using the more common compressed air, again, the only thing we're going to ask you for is there any required maintenance, lubrication, spraying? Are you autoclaving it appropriately? Because as I've learned, having worked in several dental programs, some handpieces manufacturers have different specified requirements, different temperatures or different times than what you may be using for your other instruments. And, you know, when handpieces can run well over $1,000 a piece, you don't want to autoclave them at the incorrect temperature, especially too high, and you may damage a very expensive piece of equipment. Moving on to slide number 13, hazardous material inventory. And I just put a picture there of some of the items I've come across in dental programs. I think sometimes our non-dental folks are quite shocked to see what we like to play with in the dental departments, whether it's from a chemical standpoint, or even, sometimes they don't even realize that we're potentially using flammables like, hand-out torches, little butane torches. And often when I have one of the medical folks coming with me doing our surveys, many of them are absolutely stunned to see what they'll find in dental. So, and that's, I think, sometimes how it leads to the fact that many of these hazardous materials that are pretty hazardous aren't getting onto the organization-wide hazardous material list because, again, it's the usual, it's just dental. And things on slide 14, are there any dental products on the inventory? If you don't have any dental products on the inventory, you're missing something. Do you have the correct disposal process? And we'll talk about that a little bit in the upcoming slides. Eyewash stations, according to OSHA regs, are needed if you have caustic or corrosive chemicals. Dentistry by nature and definition is using caustic and corrosive chemicals. There's almost nothing that we're using that doesn't hit that definition. So you do need to have an eyewash station available. If you ask, the OSHA regs will tell you it has to be within approximately a 10-second walk from wherever somebody would be providing care or coming in contact with these items. If you want to be certain and convince yourself, you can look in your SDS sheets as to what products would fall under this. There's a little key code that the safety data sheets use. If it uses the phrase, must flush eyes or body part for at least 15 minutes, that's OSHA code for eyewash station. You can use a squeeze bottle to get you to an eyewash station, but a squeeze bottle can't provide the 15-minute flush. So that would, almost by definition, if you're using any type of restorative dentistry, you're going to be into this category. Moving on to slide 15, and this is what we were talking, please don't throw the lead foil in the trash. Your local EPA will find that, will potentially fine you and give you a very hard time about that, so you don't want to be doing that. Most of the manufacturers will ask you to collect it up, and you can recycle it through whomever your dental supplier is. They will usually provide you containers that you can just put a postage label on eventually and mail it back to them. The one that tends to come as a little bit bigger surprise is on slide 16. If you're in the world of doing either placing or removing amalgams from teeth, or probably more importantly on the extracted teeth is where it becomes a bigger problem, many, many, many organizations are putting their extracted teeth into their sharps containers. And that's correct some of the time. If it's a tooth that has no amalgam in it or silver material, for those that don't speak dental, if you're putting a tooth with no amalgam in it, you can put it basically anywhere. You can put it in a Sharps container, red bag, give it to the patient, not as much of a problem. However, the last place you want to put an extracted tooth that has an amalgam filling in it is in a Sharps container, because you've ensured that it's going to an incinerator. And it's both on the federal level and just about every state EPA rule that I've looked up says thou shalt not do that. If your hazardous waste hauler finds that you've done that, and I had some pictures I've taken, unfortunately I didn't have them in this presentation, of the top of the Stericycle box, if you ever read the top of it, will say, should not include lead foil or amalgamated teeth, because they will get themselves in trouble with the federal EPA if they find out they're incinerating these teeth, because it's basically putting the mercury, you've guaranteed that it's going up into the air. So Stericycle and many other companies will provide you, if you can see the picture on the right, they will provide you with a bucket for either amalgam scrap and or teeth that should be recycled, and they will handle that for you. But please do not throw out teeth in regular trash, and especially not in Sharps containers. But that's where I frequently see them going. Okay, on page 17, there's the picture that I was talking about a little earlier about the look-alike, sound-alike. If you're able to see that picture in color, you will see that those cartridges are almost identical and extremely difficult to tell apart. So even though the Joint Commission standard around look-alike, sound-alike medications says that the organization defines and determines which medications are look-alike, sound-alike, I would challenge you to find a more closely look-alike pair of medications anywhere else in your building. Moving on to slide 18, this is an FAQ that's posted on the Joint Commission website, because, again, a common question that I get asked is, do needles and syringes need to be locked, stored under lock and key? Because many of us tend to leave our dental supplies, like local anesthetic and needles, in drawers in patient exam rooms. Some of us, I've seen some organizations have now gone to locking them in closets and taking out what they need. Really, the standard talks about doing a risk assessment, meaning that if your patients are essentially under observation the entire time, you could make the argument or the discussion that if somebody were to go into a drawer, we would know that they were doing it, and you know, the area is essentially under constant supervision. That's kind of the same provision we use with crash carts in hospitals, that we don't lock them up because they're essentially under constant supervision, and if some unauthorized individual was trying to access them, somebody would notice them doing that. That's what it really comes down to. Unlike our medical folks, which tend to have a little more of a challenge around this, because in the medical world, you will often leave a patient with a door closed. You may hand them a gown, say, please get changed. The doctor or the provider will be in to see you in a little while, and you close the door. Now that patient is unsupervised. And in that scenario, I would certainly want to see medications and needles secured and locked. Dental environment, one, we don't ask patients to go change, generally, and we tend to have open bays and open rooms most of the time. So if your scenario is kind of the typical open bay dental program, you could make the point that your patients are essentially under constant supervision. If that's not the case, then you may want to have a little different thought process, but you can decide which is more appropriate for your setting. On slide 19, medication reconciliation. This is one of the things that really kind of gets dental providers very confused. Well, how would that apply to me? And I said, guys, it's the same process that we use in medicine for your medical colleagues are doing. It's basically a three-step process that I like to boil down to very basic steps. What are you taking? Over-the-counters, prescriptions, so forth and so on, vitamins, herbals. That's no different than what we ask our medical folks to do, and it's something we typically do in dentistry, and that's not really the challenge for us, because when patients come in and sit in the chair, okay, what are you taking? And we're pretty good about that part of it. Step two is what is referred to as the reconciliation step. And reconciliation is, okay, let's see what you're taking. Is that going to impact anything we're doing or anything I may give you as a prescription later on? So if I'm already on an antibiotic or I'm already on a pain medication, I may decide not to double you up. You may be on an anticoagulant like Eliquis, Coumadin, or any of the Xarelto or any of the others that are on the market. That might be problematic if we're planning to do anything on the surgical realm. So what is it that the patient is taking that may or may not impact our ability to provide the care we're deciding to provide? And again, we tend to do a pretty good job of that in dental. Where the challenge comes in is in step three, which is the take-home list if additional changes are made. So if you tell me or through your medical provider to hold my Coumadin for 3 days before the procedure, please give me some idea on my take-home sheet when I can restart. Don't tell me wait to your next appointment to see your medical provider, and they'll tell you when it's okay to restart. If you're stopping me, then you should really be giving me some direction on there. Okay, please restart in a day, 2 days, 3 days, whatever you may have discussed with the medical provider. Also, if you're asking me to take some antibiotics, if you're asking me to take pain medication, I would expect that to be on there. Now, what you don't have to do in the dental world, and this would be applicable, the standard also says if you're only providing medications of short-term duration, i.e., antibiotics and pain medication, you do not need to rewrite the entire take-home med list for the patient if they're on 15 other medications, as long as you've done nothing to those other medications, like either alter a dose or ask them to hold or discontinue or do something else. If you've done nothing with their other existing meds that they walked in the door with, the only thing that needs to be on the take-home list are any new medications, again, that would be like antibiotics or pain medications. On to slide 20, universal protocol, site marking. I get frequently asked, how do I site mark a tooth? Well, having been a dentist for about 30 years, I've learned a couple of important lessons around that. This is typically where what we refer to as the alternative process in place. The general usual site marking that we might do for a knee surgery or an eye surgery typically doesn't come into play in dentistry. It's very difficult to mark teeth in the conventional methods. What I've heard from providers, and I never did this myself, is that Sharpie marker doesn't taste very good. And you can either mark it on the consent form. I've seen people do it in their electronic record. People have separate forms. They will involve the patient in pointing out using a mirror, and then the other folks, your dental assistant and others, will document that method. You come up with the method that makes sense to you. On slide 21, I'm just showing one example. This happened to be an example that came off of one of the electronic systems that are out there. You can, your site marking can be your dental charting, whether it's on a screen or it's on a piece of paper. It really doesn't matter, but somewhere or another, you should have the alternative site marking process in place. And on slide 22, the actual timeout. This is no different than a timeout that you would do anywhere else. You do the timeout just prior to beginning the procedure, wherever it is. One of the challenges that I do see is often a provider will come in, they will do a timeout, they will give the local anesthetic, and then they'll leave to see three other patients and come back 20 minutes later. In that scenario, there would be an expectation that a new timeout's done, because I had an oral surgeon that did that once in one of my clinics, and he came back to the room and extracted the wrong tooth. He had given a block in the lower and took out a lower second molar instead of the lower third molar because he got disoriented when he came back into the room. So the expectation would be that if you're leaving the room at any point or time, that when you re-enter the room, a new timeout would be there. And what we'd be worried about is, again, making sure we've got the correct patients, the correct site, the correct procedure. And when I talk to people about the universal protocol, I always tell them, well, depending on what type of procedure you're providing, whether it's a medical procedure, a GYN procedure, dental procedure, of these three items, some of them will move to a more important have a higher importance on the list than others. Well, the patient is probably well identified, but we'll still confirm that at that point. The procedure, you probably want to make sure you've got the right procedure. Dentistry, it's the location of the site is really the big challenge. I often joke with my medical providers that you're kind of like playing black and red and roulette, and we're playing the numbers 1 to 32. So in our world of dentistry, we have 32 options of taking teeth out where our medical colleagues are generally a left or right situation. So it's just paying a little more attention to the site. To me, that would probably be the number one issue, because we've all had patients come back to us after an extraction and say, Doc, you took the wrong tooth out because my mouth still hurts. So it's always important to make sure that, in my career, I've seen many wrong teeth extracted. So getting that 1 out of 32 right is kind of an important part of the timeout process. And then the last part is, if you're doing the timeout, make sure you give yourself credit for it by documenting it some way. Are somewhere. Now, be careful about this, because many of the dental programs do have a built-in template that will document a timeout was done, but if I'm standing in your exam room and I'm watching and absolutely no timeout occurs, almost 100% of the time, Their record has documented the fact that a timeout occurred. So be careful if you're using the templated records that a timeout actually does occur and you're not documenting something that didn't occur. All right, on slide 23, we're going to start into our infection prevention discussion, and then moving into slide 24. These are the types of questions that either I will ask in the dental area or at least thoughts that would cross my mind. Are dental staff properly using the surface cleaning products and PPE? Often I will see staff only wearing gloves, not wearing eye protection, not wearing masks. They're scrubbing and cleaning instruments without wearing a gown, or that the gown that's got blood splatter all over it from cleaning instruments in the dirty utility room is the same gown they're wearing out and now they're assisting you on your next procedure. So we're looking at the PPE use. Are dental supplies checked periodically for removal of expired materials? Very common, whether it's your composite materials or your local anesthetics, those things all have expiration dates, and very frequently do we find many of those have expired. Are you using cassettes to contain small dental instruments? If there is no requirement that you do that, but pay attention to your peel pouches because as we all know, explorers and other sharp items will puncture through. And if you're like most people using what we call event-related sterilization, which means as long as the package is intact, you don't need to reprocess it, that extra 2 seconds needs to be spent when you actually look at the peel pack, because, again, when you pile those up in a drawer somewhere, frequently you'll find the sharp edges poking out, and that would necessitate that item to be reprocessed. Also making sure that if you have what we call a hinged instrument, like a hemostat or a pair of scissors, that it's both sterilized and maintained in the open position. That's a new issue that's been popping up lately. Where are the instruments pre-cleaned? There's an expectation that at least in the exam room there's a basic wipe off of the instruments. Again, it's not going to be a high-level cleaning disinfection. At least if there's any gross debris, whether it's restorative material, debris, blood, bone, whatever it is, that at least things are getting wiped off there. Do instruments sit for any period of time? If they're sitting for any period of time, there's an expectation that they're kept wet or sprayed with an enzymatic spray so that debris doesn't dry on them. And when you're transporting them, they're transported in closed containers so that somebody come running around the corner isn't going to get a face full of instruments if they bump into somebody carrying them in their hand, which is unfortunately something you do see frequently in many of the dental areas. How do we know the staff cleaning and sterilizing the instruments are competent? What you got to be careful of is what I like to call the training game of telephone, which is somebody trains somebody who trains somebody who trains somebody, and by the time it got to the third or fourth trainee, the entire message may have dramatically changed. So it's making sure that people are cleaning things to the appropriate competence that you expect them to. Who's overseeing the sterilization and infection control program? Because frequently when I ask that question, the answer I will get is, oh, it's our office manager. Now, the office manager may be an administrator and have absolutely no clinical background and absolutely no background in infection prevention. So we're looking for somebody that actually knows or has some experience or understanding of what is required to process instruments in the infection control program. And is dental, just asking even a basic question, oh, I understand your health center has an infection control committee. Is anybody from dental on the committee? And occasionally I will still get the answer is, that's a great idea, we never thought about that. So make sure that, because they're probably processing more instruments than anybody else, so making sure that there's dental representation on your infection control committee is, to me, is quite important. Over to slide 25, remember, dental procedures are clean. What we're really trying to prevent is patient-to-patient transmission. You're not working in a sterile area of the body. However, instruments still need to be stored wrapped. I'm still occasionally going to organizations where they will sterilize their instruments, but they don't wrap them, and they just dump them in a drawer. Everything's got to be wrapped in one way or another, because, again, what we're worried about is somebody taking their dirty hand and reaching into the drawer and grabbing something. There's very little anymore in dentistry that requires high-level disinfection. If you're using Cydex, please don't use it. Virtually everything in dentistry now can either be sterilized or disposable. And even worse, if you're soaking instruments in Cydex or Cydex OPA prior to cleaning them or sterilizing, that is a totally incorrect sterilant product to soak them in, because what glutaraldehyde does, and at the end part, if you remember your chemistry, aldehyde, is like formaldehyde. What it actually does, it will fix debris onto your instruments. So it's actually worse than doing nothing. So please don't use Cydex or Cydex OPA, but primarily the Cydex, to soak instruments. And I've come across a few health centers thinking, well, if, you know, sterilization is good, soaking in a high-level disinfectant is better beforehand. What you're actually doing is almost making it impossible to get the debris off the instruments. When you're writing or stamping on your packages to know when you're, what date you're processing, always, always do it on the plastic side of your peel pack. Do not do it on the paper side. I've had situations where organizations were kind of surprised and couldn't understand why they were seeing black on their instruments. The ink will sometimes get driven through the paper, or if you write with a pen or a pencil, you will often see perforations or holes in the paper. So any writing is either on a piece of tape or on the plastic side of the peel pack. We mentioned earlier you're doing event-related sterilization, and make sure that you're doing the appropriate biological monitoring. CDC says minimum requirement is weekly. There is no requirement to do it more than that. I see it, people doing it from every load to once a week and everything in between. I usually, you know, when people ask me, well, how often should we do it? My answer is usually, how well do you want to sleep at night? Or if asked slightly differently, how many people do you want to call when you have an autoclave failure? If you're seeing 50 patients a day and you're doing once a week testing and you're mailing it away, you're probably going to have to call 200 to 300 patients if you have an autoclave failure. If you're doing it daily, that number is going to drop dramatically down to probably 40 or 50. If you did it every load, you may have to call 3 or 4 patients. So it all depends on where your comfort level is, but the minimum is weekly. That's all we score on, is at least if you're doing it weekly. Just realize that if you are doing the mail-away method, you're adding several days to the process. So it's not only just a week, but you're adding at least 3 to 5 additional days onto that. On slide 26, we're talking about adopt the guideline. There are numerous guidelines out there regarding infection prevention. There's at least 7 I've listed there. And the reason that that's important is we, as surveyors, were all trained and have been trained and had re-education this past January on every organization's infection control guidelines are different. The expectations are different. The amount of documentation is different. Just by looking at what kind of, how to do biological and chemical indicators varies. So if you tell me you're following the OSHA guideline, then I'm going to expect weekly biologicals, and on every package it has a chemical indicator. AORN has a different guideline. So we only hold you, we meaning the surveyors, only hold you to your selected guideline. And be careful, because I do walk into dental departments and ask them whose guideline you're following, and they give me a list of 6 different guidelines. Really difficult to get, especially when you get into the world of AORN and AIME. Those are both very difficult guidelines, and there's very few dental departments that can meet those to every extent, because some of these guidelines are 100 pages long, and you have to follow every component of it. So, one, pick a guideline. 2, read the guideline carefully to make sure that you can comply with it. I will tell you just from experience, most dental departments are following CDC. It is the easiest to follow and the most reasonable to follow. So it's just knowing whose guideline you're following and then make sure you're following it in its entirety. On slide 27, surveyor question, I frequently will ask that your folks who are doing the sterilization in the sterilization area is, how do you know that, how do you monitor your sterilization process? And usually I'll get, you know, maybe, well, we do some biologicals is an answer. Then I'll say, let me ask you a follow-up question. Could you tell me what your physical, chemical, and biological indicators are? And that's when I usually go get the deer in the headlights look. And what we're referring to is physical indicators are basically your autoclave readings, time, temperature, pressure. You can either A, write it down off the screen that is on, if your autoclave has that. B, if your autoclave has a tape printout, I highly encourage you to use it. If it doesn't have one and you can get one, because your staff, it's basically done for it. It comes out like a little cash register receipt and says, run number whatever it is, done on this date at this time, and it documents the fact that the autoclave reached the correct time, temperature, and pressure. The chemical indicators are either your tape or the little inserts that you'll see the picture of there. That will either go inside or outside the package, depending on what it is. Sometimes some of your peel packs even will have the chemical indicators built in. And what I'll often hear from staff when I ask them why they're doing that, they'll tell me, oh, it's because that tells us the instrument is sterile. No, a chemical indicator tells you that the package has gone into a steam autoclave and has been processed. It tells you nothing about sterility. It's just your way of separating sterile instruments that have been processed versus instruments that have not been processed. The only thing that really tells you sterilization definitively is the biological indicator that you're using. On slide number 28, the common breaches, these are things that we have seen over the, I looked back at survey reports for the last couple of years. These are all a list of all the different things that that have come up frequently. And again, these are probably the top 10 or 15 most commonly found infection control violations. So you can look through that at your leisure, just to give you a sense of what we're seeing out there. On slide 29, we often get questions around, well, do I have to have temperature monitoring and humidity monitoring, and do I have to have separate rooms for my sterilization clean and dirty rooms? The answer would be ideally yes, but in reality, no. So the guidelines for health infection control and dental health care guidelines allow you to have a one room. Again, what they're really looking for is clean, dirty separation. As long as you can provide designated areas, it's in many dental offices, it's almost impossible to have two separate rooms, to have appropriate, you know, air pressures. It just isn't going to happen. So to be realistic about it, the guidelines here allow you to basically have a clean, dirty separation as long as everything has a one-directional flow. A relatively new issue on slide 30 is what I call the multi-use dental dispensers. Many of us use these, have used these. This has been tying both the American Dental Association, CDC, and others in knots for the last couple of years. It's driving them kind of crazy because, on the one hand, we reuse these all the time. We change the tip, thank you very much, and I move on to the next patient. But if you look at the Spalding classification that CDC uses, and it says basically any item that comes in contact with mucous membranes, which last definition I looked at, the mouth would fall under that, would require high-level disinfection. Well, that's not going to happen to most of those syringes because you'll either destroy the product or destroy the packaging that it's in. And on the other hand, providers typically don't want to throw these out because some of these syringes can go as much as $100 depending on the material, and you're getting $35 for the procedure. You're not going to throw out $100 tube of material that could probably treat 20 or 30 patients. So after a lot of, you know, grinding of teeth and arguing, the ADA and FDA and CDC sat down in a room somewhere and came up with a compromise, and I provided you with the website there on slide 31. But basically, they came up with what I think is a reasonable accommodation for everybody concerned. So what they do want you to do is put a little disposable barrier, I call the little Ziploc bag, that goes over just like we frequently do with our hand pieces and we do with our air water syringes, to cover it over, and use obviously a new tip with each one. Use new uncontaminated gloves when handling it, and avoid contact of reusable parts with the mouth. If we move on to slide 33, what they don't want you to do is reuse it if it becomes contaminated. So if you put the plastic bag on or the plastic wrap over the syringe, you put it in somebody's mouth, and blood or body fluid, meaning saliva primarily, were to get up and contact it, that's when that syringe should be thrown out, because at that point it's a non-cleanable product. Don't reprocess them. Don't immerse them. I've seen people try to soak them in cleaner. Don't do that. They find that it actually seeps in and gets into the dental material itself. And obviously we can't autoclave it or sterilize it because it'll turn into a little pile of plastic and just melt away. But, you know, generally if you're using rubber dam or you're using a dental procedure, if you're using any of these products, they all require a dry field. So the chance of that syringe getting contact with saliva or blood is relatively low. But the best example I can think of where it may occur is if you were using it in many of the UltraDent products, if you're using it for hemostasis after, like, for example, a crown prep or something along the gingival margin, that's probably the one time or the procedure where you're most likely going to run into potential blood contamination. But if you're good about how you handle it, you keep the plastic bag on and you just do minimal application with the tip, you can get away with reusing it. But that's something that is relatively new, but the website there will provide you with even more detail. On slide 34, dental water lines, we're going to ask you what your process is for maintaining the dental water lines, because the CDC recommendation is 500 CFUs or colony-forming units per line, per milliliter. So we want to make sure that you have some sort of process, whether it's you flush the lines with certain chemicals at certain intervals, or you have one of those more automated ozone systems. Really doesn't matter. just tell us what your process is for maintaining it. So on slide 36, there is actually a great handout put out by CDC that goes over the infection prevention checklist for dental settings. Dental is, again, one of the most common areas for health centers for getting citations in the infection control area, so please reference that. There's also they basically turned that booklet into an app. So those of you, I don't know if it's available on Android yet, but I know it's available on Apple, and I've used it many times. That link there, you can just download the app there to your phone. It will pretty much link or list all of the dental requirements for the CDC checklist, and you can walk through your dental clinic just clicking yes or no, and you can email the results of that report to yourself. You can save them to your phone, but it goes through every section of the CDC infection control guidelines. And what you'll see is on slide 38, I just showed an example of what the app actually looks like, and you can do it through the phone or just put it on your computer and print out the checklist also. On slide 39, one of the last questions I will ask the dental folks is, in any way you included, to Dr. Wynn's point, is dental included in performance improvement or quality activities? And again, it's just dental. They don't have anything that's of quality relevance. And that's pretty far from the truth. Dental does have things that would be relevant. And I gave you some examples here on slide 39. How often do dental items, appliances come back from the lab and they don't fit? That's a huge cost savings if you can figure out what's going on there. How often are we retaking films or redos of x-ray films? Patients coming back within a certain number of days requiring additional medications, restorations being replaced within a certain time frame, no-show rates. These are all examples that I've collected over the years of what I've seen other health centers use to collect different types of PI projects that would be relevant to dental. So, again, back to my original point that we talked about a little while ago is don't forget dental. It's not the question of if these standards apply. It's just understanding, and again, if it helps to use the term, call it your oral medicine department, because then you'll start to think like your other departments, and it may not be as much of a foreign concept. So with that, I will call my presentation to a close, and thank you for listening.
Dr. Echo, thank you so much for the wealth of very helpful and detailed information. It's a great presentation. So now, Chantel, I'd like to open up the call to questions. So if anyone has any questions.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we would like to open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question.
And I wanted to share while we're waiting for the questions to come in to mark your calendars for our upcoming teleconference. This is scheduled in the future for Thursday, April 5th. Our conference will be Medication Management and Standards Compliance with one of our surveyors, again, Valerie Henriquez. On Thursday, May 3rd, we'll have Environment of Care and Facilities Management, another one of our Bureau of Primary Health Care surveyors, Joe Flannery. And then on Thursday, July 7th, we will have Systems Thinking and Designs with, again, one of our Bureau of Primary Health Care surveyors, Kathy Noren. So we've got some great sessions coming up, so please mark your calendars for those sessions.
Thank you. Our first question will come from...
Therese, Family Health Centers of Baltimore.
Hello. The question that I had is about the instrument processing. It says do not write or stamp on the paper side of the bags. What material would you use on the plastic side, or where could we purchase the product from?
I've seen people use either just Sharpie marker, but again, marking on the plastic side, and Sharpie will mark on the plastic, or there are labels. I call it the pricing gun, and I've seen people use that. If you have a high volume of instruments, some people have bought the little kind of pricing gun where we'll stamp the date and the time and the load number, and they'll just stamp the instrument. But most, I'd say 75% of folks are using basically just a good Sharpie marker.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from...
Corey Hernandez, North County Health Services.
Yes, good morning from California. Would like to see if I didn't get the information regarding the presentation. I would like to see if I would be able to get that still.
Hey, Pam,
yes,
I think
absolutely.
You can assist there.
Yes, and if you would like to send me an email, pkompereda joincommission.org. I can send you that. We will also have the slide deck and the recorded session on our website within the next day or two, so we'll have that information there too. But please send me an email, and I'll send you the presentation.
No, please. I'm sorry. I didn't get the presentation because it went through. Apparently, went through our clinical director, and he didn't provide it to me.
Okay, no problem. My email address again is pkomperd@jointcommission.org.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Darren Stites, Family Health Center.
Hi.
Hello.
No, I was just also looking for the presentation slides because lots of, you know, apps and other website addresses were mentioned. So I think we'll email you then. Thank you.
Yes, great. Thank you. Please do so.
Thank you very much. Our next question will come from
Calvin Hoops, Esperanza Health Center. Hi, this is Calvin. Thank you, Dr. Afro, for this presentation. It's been really helpful. I did have one question regarding infection control. You had mentioned one of the points, the sterilization breaches. You had mentioned that instruments are allowed to dry after the initial growth cleaning. But that, I was just wondering if there was any clarification, because that seems at odds with the sterilization requirements that the instruments be dry before placing in the sterilizer.
Oh, this is, well, it's the step kind of in between, which is maybe in the operatory you've wiped off the gross debris, but you really haven't ultrasonic them, cleaned them, anything like that. What I'm referring to is this: the step from when it leaves the operatory before it gets into the ultrasonic or has the cleaning. Yes, you do want to dry them once they've been cleaned and before they go into the sterilizer.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. If your question has already been answered, you may press star 2 to remove yourself from the queue. Our next question will come from
Lisa McDonald, UNHS. Good afternoon. This is Lisa. I was just checking on the one question I had. We do have the look-alike, sound-alike for the septocaine and carbocaine and those. But what I was questioning is, do they always have to be under lock? We have them under supervision, like you said, with our staff. But we were told that because housekeeping comes in there, that we would have to have them locked up and not.
Yeah, and that may be the situation. Again, it's very, you know, it's very site specific. But if you told me that after hours, everything would be accessible to folks walking through the area, especially, you know, some health centers have housekeeping and just during the day when their staff are there, and that wouldn't be an issue. I would, you know, if I were doing the risk assessment, I'd be concerned about the after hours folks. So what I see people doing is either A, just collecting up, you know, they'll keep the certain items and they'll just collect them up at the box and lock them in a closet each night, or if it's simpler, some people will just find, you know, they'll have one cabinet that has a lock on it, and they'll do it that way. But, yeah, you do have to consider the after-hours possibilities also.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Name not recorded.
Melissa Casea, Greater Elgin Family Care Center. Hi, everyone. I actually have three questions. question one, for instrument processing, is using pencil on the paper side of the package kosher?
No.
Or must it
no.
be?
That's even worse because, not. No, nothing goes on the paper side of the package because what they found, especially with pencil, pencil's probably the worst offender, it will puncture holes without you realizing it.
Okay, got it. Second question, what do you recommend for the disposal of empty amalgam capsules?
What I'm hearing is that, you know, most folks are saying it should go in wherever you're putting your amalgam scrap. So whatever methodology, because it can be contaminated with mercury.
Okay. And last question, does the Joint Commission require hand pieces and motors that are able to be heat sterilized should be heat sterilized between every single patient?
It would come back to your, what does the manufacturer say? So typically if you're using a slow speed or a high speed, the question I would ask is, can it be sterilized? And if your manufacturer says, yes, it can, which my understanding is the vast majority are right now, then the question would be, why wouldn't you do it?
Got it. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Dr. Muller, Community Health Center, Chief Dental Officer. Oh, hi, thank you for the wonderful presentation. So I have three questions. One is in regards to the non-lead aprons. So you did say to inspect for the cracks, you know, in lead aprons. So do we have to follow the same protocol for the non-lead aprons as well?
Yes, you're referring to the barium aprons, and I'm a big fan of those because they don't tend to crack and they have a much better lifespan. You still should be inspecting them, but typically what you're inspecting for is not so much the cracks because, again, it's usually a fabric layer of barium material on the inside. You're just looking at the outside, kind of a superficial inspection, just to make sure that you don't have any rips, tears, or nicks in the outer vinyl or plastic covering on it, but that's all you'd really be looking for. It's just a periodic inspection just to make sure that you don't have an infection control issue. But, yeah, and I was surprised to find out recently the barium aprons are not significantly more expensive than the lead. Patients tend to like them a whole lot more because they're a lot lighter and they're a lot easier to maintain.
True, yeah. We're in the process of, changing everything to non-lead, as the need comes. The second question that I have is, we do use the amalgam way, to recycle the amalgam. They said it was okay to put the extracted teeth with amalgam in the amalgam way bucket. However, they're not providing us any information. Is it okay? Can we put the extracted teeth? They're not providing us that information. Okay, you can go ahead and put the extracted teeth, of amalgam in the bucket. So is it okay to still go ahead and put the extracted teeth with amalgam in the amalgam way bucket, even though they did not give us any literature around it?
Well, what I've heard, when I asked that question around the country, and there's a few major providers, like Stericycle is one of the bigger ones, but there's a few others out there. What I'm hearing is it's very company specific. I know with Stericycle, they will provide you with a separate bucket. They want it segregated because I guess the process that they use for reprocessing the amalgam, it would be challenged if you mix the teeth in with the regular scrap amalgam. I've heard from other health centers that their vendors say, no problem, put it all together, we'll sort it out later. So it's pretty much up to your individual company how they'd like you to do it.
Yeah, that's what they were saying. Thank you. And my last question, sorry. You did say that no instrument should be, kept, without a pouch. So we do, in dental, we do use a lot of burrs that take it out from a big pouch and, put in those, boxes for the ease of use. Is that okay still?
Yeah, the burrs are a slightly different situation. Now, I'm going to encourage you, if they're operative burrs like 330s and 56s and things like that, please seriously think about disposable on that end. Just because, there's lots of issues around trying to clean those appropriately. Things like diamonds and finishing burrs, which are obviously a lot more expensive and a lot more durable, I've seen, people will reprocess those. Those are a little more, it's a little more difficult. I mean, on the one hand, it makes sense that you should wrap things, and I do see people using little pouches to wrap burrs, and they'll have little setups that, they'll have the little plastic setups that will have them contained. That one's kind of, as I like to say, the jury's still out on that one.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Linda Ali Morad, Dental Director, CCI Health and Wellness Services.
Hello, everyone. I have two questions regarding treatment planning. I joined even the conference for NOAA for Community Health Center across the country. Is it do we need to present a defined treatment plan for each patient or the consent form for the general one that we get for treatment at the community clinic would be good enough? because private practice, I know that they need to provide even prices, it's like a contract, and both parties would sign it and each one get a copy. What was your recommendation on that?
What our standard says around consent is the organization has a policy and follows it. So what I will ask is, what's your process and policy? So depending on whatever your process would be, is we hold you to your process. So there is nothing in the standards manual that says you have to do it one way or the other. It just says develop a policy that says this is how we obtain consent for treatment or whatever. The, you know, I've seen people do, you know, get individual consents for every procedure. Other people do, as you mentioned, a little more of a treatment plan, kind of general consent. There's different ways people can do it. So there's really no one prescriptive way to do it. What I would recommend is just have a really clear policy that describes what your process is, and then just make sure that your staff are following it.
Okay. And my second question is, again, is regarding treatment planning. We see lots of pediatric patients, and ADA guidelines for x-rays says that as long as there is open contact and we can see all the teeth visually, we are okay not to get x-ray for age 4 years and younger.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there is a cavity for anterior teeth, you can see it clearly and you put it on the note that it was clinically observed, and the legal guardian or parents confirm it when we do treatment. Is it like okay to not have x-ray when we treat those kind of teeth?
Yeah, well, in that situation, that's what we call a peer review situation, meaning that's a clinical judgment call. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, Joint Commission does not step into that realm. They're not going to tell you how to provide care. I might ask you, are you following relevant national guidelines? And as long as you're following the relevant guidelines, you know, again, you're not going to get much of a discussion from me at that point. You know, if you're following the ADA guidelines, there's nothing in the Joint Commission manual that's going to tell you otherwise. You know, it tends to be a very generic standards that say, you know, have a treatment plan and follow it, but it's not going to tell you exactly, it's not prescriptive to say you must or must not take x-rays.
Okay. And the last question is about the amalgam separation. We have the container for extracted tooth, and we also put it on the consent form before we extract the tooth. The tooth has amalgam or do not have amalgam. But what's the Joint Commission recommendation for restoration of the tooth with amalgam?
And do whatever you want, but...
So there is no grant, like if you don't, the Joint Commission is not looking for, like, you need to have the amalgam separator in the water line.
No, the amalgam separator on the water line, that's usually a state requirement. Most states now require that. I know I practice in New Hampshire and I also practice in Massachusetts. They've had that requirement for about 10 years now. I know there's some states that are still kind of getting up to that, and I think it's just gone national, but that's pretty much a legal requirement. So the Joint Commission wouldn't have much say in that, because if your state, like in New Hampshire, says, look, you have to have it, doesn't matter what the Joint Commission says, that's a state requirement in order to maintain your license.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from...
Kristen Hendershot, All Care Health Center.
Yes, I have a question regarding the pre-cleaning of instruments.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly do you mean by that? You mean we're supposed to be wiping them off of debris prior to putting them in the ultrasonic?
No, it's a recommendation. You know, if you've got a heavy amount of composite or sealant material stuck all over an Explorer, it's usually recommended to wipe the heavy, you know, at least do a wipe off or something in the room is the recommendation, before it dries on the instrument. I mean, you can still clean it in the procedural area, but there's a recommendation, I mean, that from CDC that at least in the room, what they use the term, any gross debris is removed from the instruments. So
okay,
that's currently the CDC recommendation.
Okay. And then I do have another question about writing on the pouches.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that has changed as of January of this year? Because last time we had Joint Commission out, they told us not to write on the plastic or the paper.
No, you can write on the
you can
write on the plastic side. It's the paper side that's the problem.
Okay. And what were you talking about? Some kind of scanning device that will put all of that information on there for you?
Oh, there are some devices that some of the manufacturers are selling. I call it the pricing gun. Where it basically, it's the old days, you remember the days of putting price stickers on items in the grocery store.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen several health, it's just the paper stickers.
Okay, and then like a dental manufacturer would be able to get that for me, or would it be more like an office supply?
I've seen both. I've seen some of the, you know, I would probably start with your dental suppliers to see if anyone has it. If not, I would look at, you know, one of your office suppliers, because I've seen it in many health centers, and that way they just set the numbers for that particular day and just makes it really quick, the label dates and autoclave numbers and things like that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Rose Robert, please, LG Temple Health Center.
Thank you for this. This was really useful. I'm the quality improvement manager at my site, and it's funny because today I did an infection control round at a dental unit. It's one of the first time because we're really trying to establish processes in that department. And one question that I have and is when you have a multi-dose item, does it for dental? For example, the question that came up for us was, you know, the fluoride, do you still follow that multi-dose 28-day expiration calculation for them?
No.
Does it not apply?
No, the 28-day discard, as you're referring to for multi-dose medications, applies mm-hmm. to injectable medications only.
So it's only injectable, okay.
It doesn't apply to topicals. I've seen people throw out bottles of, you know, Vaseline, skin mm-hmm. lotion. I mean, if it doesn't apply to bacitracin, no. It does not only applies to something if you had like a multi-dose vial of lidocaine, for example. That would get tossed out after 28 days.
Okay. Thank you
so
much.
So it has to be an injectable.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Manchu Diwari, Yakima Valley Public Clinic. Hey, hi. Thank you so much for such a wonderful presentation. My question is regarding X-ray signage posting for the pregnant female, pregnant patients who come to mm-hmm. our clinic, dental clinic. Is there a requirement around that? And if we need to, then do we need to post those signage in each and every operatory, or how do we do that?
There is no joint commission requirement for posting of signage. However, some states do have a requirement. So, again, it would be depending on what state you're in. I would probably ask the dental board or the state board of registration. They could probably tell you, because I have come across a couple of states that do have some signage requirements.
Okay. The next question I have is around storage. So, I understand the medications, and they should be logged, but do we need to keep the normal supplies also under lock and key, especially in the storage supply rooms?
Typically the things that you would need to keep secured, as I like to say, things that you would not want somebody walking away with. So if you're talking about your medications, your sharps, your needles, your instruments, no, I probably wouldn't want those walking away. If you have a closet that contains paper towels, some gauze, some patient bibs, no, I wouldn't be too worried about that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from
Name not recorded.
Dr. Foster, Neon. Thank you. My question, I have a couple, but the first one relates to the clean and dirty room that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
This mainly is a situation for a medical in terms of whether there is a separate room, or is this, because I noticed you mentioned that it wasn't mandatory for a dental.
Right. Yeah, for dental they're giving, because in many dental situations, it's just impossible to occur. So rather than shutting down 90% of the dental offices in the country, the organizations that come up with some of those building guidelines has kind of given dental a pass, as long as, again, you've got kind of a clean to dirty flow and you don't have kind of a one-way directionality, is where they're not giving that pass to our medical colleagues.
Okay. The next question has to do with the sinks in the sterilization area.
Mm-hmm.
Is it required that there be a separate sink in order to have a separate one for hand washing, or how is that handled?
Yes, ideally you do not want somebody washing their hands in basically what you would call your dirty sink. So, yeah, that sometimes is the challenge for some folks in their dirty utility room, is do we have a sink that's designated for hand washing versus, or is there at least a sink available close by? because what you're going to find is those dirty sinks are pretty dirty if you've cleaned enough dental instruments in them. So the
right.
rule of thumb is generally to have a separate hand washing area.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from.
I was going to be brought to the lunch sometime today. We'll have our start type of thoughts there.
Okay.
Jackie Doyle, Hemed Health Center. Good afternoon. I have one question regarding sterilization. We are a very large dental practice, and our health center is now has now opened a women's health department. We also now have a podiatry department.
Mm-hmm.
So we're slowly but surely becoming central sterilization. Is
okay.
there somewhere that I could go to find out the different requirements? Because it's, I mean, we're very, very specific about our dental requirements, but this stuff is all new to me. So I want to find out where
well,
I can get that information.
The simple answer is there is no difference.
Okay.
A metal surgical instrument is the same whether it's in women's health, podiatry, or dental. It basically, the process is exactly the same. Typically, like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, pick a guideline, whether it's AORN, CDC, AMI, APIC, whoever you like.
Mm-hmm.
That basically, so that will become your template. Again, most people in health centers realistically will use CDC because it's the most reasonable guideline.
Right, that's where we're at.
Right, and if you select CDC, it will, you know, there's a guideline specifically for dental, but there's one for kind of, I call it for everybody else. And
okay.
essentially, you're going to see the same thing. You pre-clean your instruments, you clean your instruments, you wrap them appropriately, you do your chemical, biological, physical indicator. The process is no different for any of those three areas.
Do you recommend having, like, separate autoclaves and separate ultrasonics for those different departments?
Nope.
Okay.
If at all, personally, if I had my way, I'd put it all in one area because what tends to happen is dental will be probably the busiest, followed
mm-hmm.
by podiatry, followed by women's health.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is if you do something every day, 10 times a day, you get really good at it.
Right.
If your folks in women's health might do it once a week, they're not going to be so good at it.
Got it.
So one, you've got the competency issue. Number two, the issue, you know, because once they're in the autoclave, it doesn't matter what the instrument is. Number two is when we did a study at my facility, and we had 35 practices we consolidated into our hospital sterile processing area. We when we did a cost analysis, it was costing us $8,000 to $10,000 per autoclave per year to operate it.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, if I can consolidate everyone into two autoclaves rather than having three spread through the building, you're going to probably see a cost savings as well as probably an efficiency.
Okay,
so
great.
That would be just my opinion.
Which is where we're heading towards, so we're just making sure we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, and again, it really
question.
Doesn't matter where the instruments come from.
Got it. And then the last question I have is the clothes bins. I'm not sure about everybody else, but I know we walk around with trays from room to room going into,
mm-hmm.
and is there something specific you would recommend for those clothes bins, or... You know, just any kind of...
I've seen a couple of different methodologies. What I think is the nicest but obviously most expensive are the metal boxes or the metal cassettes where instruments
okay.
are kind of
pre-packaged. Okay, so the cassettes are
cassettes
fine.
Because
okay.
the intent is that if I come running around the corner and you're holding a closed cassette, I'm not going to get a face full of instruments if I buy...
Got it. Fine. Okay, so the cassettes are fine. I don't need to worry about that. It's just...
Nope, if
but
you've
if
got metal cassettes...
From, okay. Good. That's
where
all
the
I
problem
to
tends
know.
To come in is what I'll see is at the end of a case, somebody will have a metal cassette, they'll leave the cover off, and they'll carry the dirty instruments down the hall uncovered.
Right.
And
that's where
they'll get themselves in trouble.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much. You've been very helpful today.
You're welcome.
Hey, this is Pam Comperta. Due to the interest of time, we're going to allow for two more questions. I know we have a lot of questions still in the queue. So I'm going to ask those, if you did not have your questions answered today, if you can send those to me via email. Again, my email address is pkomperda@jointcommission.org, and we will get those your questions answered for you, and we'll get back to you. Thank you. So, Chantal, I think we can have time for two more questions.
Thank you very much. Our next question will come from
Ishra Drangwala, Family Centers.
Yes, hi. So we have a very different situation. It's a very small healthcare center with only one dental operatory. So we don't really have a separate instrument area, like a central processing area. It's in the same dental operatory. Is that okay?
Reasonably, they'd say probably no, but because, you know, you're basically cleaning instruments and you're basically providing patient care in a dirty area. It would be the explanation. Is there anywhere else in your facility that you could put it, even at least the cleaning process?
Yes, so that's what we are trying to do. Is we are trying to move at least one thing in a different room. So, like, we're trying to separate the ultrasonic cleaner and the autoclave. So the question is, which is better to separate, the ultrasonic cleaner or the autoclave?
Because at that point, you're at least bringing the clean instruments and packaged into the room to sterilize them at that point.
All right. So the autoclave can stay in the dental operatory. That's okay, then.
Yeah, that's a whole lot better than leaving the ultrasonic in there.
Perfect. Yes, I got your point. And that's what our thinking was. But then, hearing your presentation, that brings me to another question, the one-directional flow. Is that some way that's going to get affected because we're taking the dirty instrument out and we're bringing it back in the operatory to the autoclave?
Is the room that you're putting the ultrasonic in, could you put the autoclave in there?
We can, but the problem is that we don't have the... When the Joint Commission came in, they said that they both are in the same... Like, there's no, what do you call it, the spatial distinct area because they're next to each other.
What I have seen some people do is when they're really tight on spaces, you can actually put a divider up. I've seen people get like a plexiglass divider, and then on the other side, you know, it's kind of your clean side. And sometimes that's the best you can do.
All right. So instead of having ultrasonic and autoclave in different rooms and one room being the dental operatory, the better idea is to move both of them out and put a plexiglass in between
them. That would be my opinion, and do some sort of physical separation, because when you've got a situation where you're really tight on space, the best answer I've seen people do is to basically put up some sort of physical divider.
Okay. All righty. I got it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our last question will come from
Valley Health Team.
Hi, my name is Vanessa. I'm one of the RDAs here at this facility, and my question is, what do you recommend that we use when we dry instruments after getting them out of the ultrasonic?
What I see most people use is just the towel.
Just a regular paper towel?
Yep, paper towel or a linen towel, you know, or basically some sort of towel. Sometimes it's like a surgical towel I've seen people use, but there's nothing in particular. The idea is just to obviously make sure that you get them as good dry as you can, and you don't want something with a lot of lint on it, so I wouldn't use paper towels.
Okay. All righty. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you so much. I want to thank Dr. Nguyen for calling in today and being part of the call, and Dr. Afro, too, for the great presentation today. And thank all of our Health Center colleagues, too, for taking the time to listen in to our teleconference and for partnering with the Joint Commission on your journey to provide high-quality care. So, again, if you do have a question that wasn't answered due to the interest of time today, please send me an email at pcomperda, K-O-M-P-E-R-D-A, @jointcommission.org, and we'll get back to you and answer your questions. So, again, thank you so much, everyone. Have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, this conference has now concluded. You may disconnect your phone lines and have a great rest of the week. Thank you. Speakers,
thank you.
One moment.
Bye-bye.
Bye.